So this part of the day is called Perspectives on Storytelling. And even though all of us, or most of us, do many different forms of that, we've each chosen one story that we're going to focus on and try to tell you about how it started, problems we encountered, editing snafus, all kinds of things that just the evolution of the story. Do you want to go first, Serena? Okay, so Serena's going to talk about online magazine.
My online magazine, TolstadaMagazine.com. It's all based here in Detroit, Metro Detroit, where I live. And it's all focused on the perspective of people of color. So you're not going to find the hyped up white male chefs that are prevalent in New York Times and Washington Post and all these other publications that love to fly in to Detroit for a couple of days and write about our food renaissance. I launched the site last year, early last year, really having no idea what it would look like or what it would evolve into. It was more just like, if I don't buy this URL, if I don't launch this site, I never will. And I was at that perfect moment of just being like frustrated and angry. And like, as Zahir said, like feeling humiliated time and time again by, you know, working in mainstream media. So far I've published 40 stories. I was able to really become sustainable this year because I applied for a grant and I got some funding. And so I've been publishing about a story a week. Last week I published a feature story about a woman and her family who run a taco truck company here in Metro Detroit. And the story is not about necessarily a taco truck. Like, let's be honest, they're everywhere. Like, there are lots of taco trucks. There are a lot of, you know, places to get Mexican food everywhere. This story is really about this family and really about this woman who perseveres and who makes things happen and who, like, troubleshoots any particular problem that might come up in the development and operation of their business. And through that perseverance and just working hard and being a badass, like, it's one of the most popular taco truck chains in the city. People love their Al Pastor. And they've expanded numerous times. And so in terms of how I approach the story.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Do you know who your audience is, and did you know when you first started?
Yeah. I honestly don't care if I appeal to the reader or like the Eater Detroit audience. I don't care if I'm appealing to like those hyped up chefs. I've been writing about food for about 4 years, and you know, I went through like this evolution in terms of like who my audience is. I'll be honest, like I did appreciate and pay attention to, you know, to whether people were sharing my stories. I sought that validation really. When I launched Tostada though, I was like, I'm not writing about you guys anymore. And so I really had to abandon that mainstream like acceptance and say, my audience is really my people. And my audience are other communities that also desire to be represented, to be seen in the media, to feel like we're having an intimate conversation. So that's really who my audience is.
Okay, Vaughn, you wanna go next? So let's keep it to about 5 minutes and then we'll return with other questions.
Okay. Oh Lord.
I know, 6 minutes for you.
What is the question?
Oh no, so Vaughn just published her first cookbook And I want you to tell us, deconstruct, how did it start? Why did it start? What changed when you were doing it? And show and tell?
Sure. I'm going to pass a copy around because it's easier to like look at it and flip through it.
Oh, right. Also because it's gorgeous.
Sorry. Yes, it is gorgeous. And actually, my photographer is Sibel Kodish, who is an award-winning photographer who is Detroit-based. And she is incredible. And as an aside, when we traveled to Puerto Rico together to produce photography for this book, she felt so at home that it kind of haunted her in like a really good way. And then she did an ancestry test and learned that she has Puerto Rican ancestry. So anyway, as an aside, the brujas in the room get, I was like, I knew it. Okay, let me just pull out my little outline. So I have an unusual story of coming to a cookbook that I always like to tell people because si se puede and like dreams do come true. I was freelancing. I was actually working a full-time gig right after grad school, and I was starting to freelance, and I really wanted to, as I told y'all, find my voice and write about food. And I decided that I was going to start by writing a few simple food pieces for Feet in Two Worlds with Kathy Gunst and John Rudolph as my mentors and editors, and that expanded to a couple of radio pieces. I produced some terrible YouTube videos that I highly encourage y'all to watch because they make me giggle. At this point, I like was badly drilling holes in coconuts with a power drill and cooking a whole beef tongue, which is really gross to look at. Delicious to eat, but really ugly. So I was doing all this stuff, and I was kind of, not maybe consciously at the time, sort of building an audience, but I was kind of practicing. I was playing in a lot of ways. I was like, oh, I kind of like this format, and I kind of like this. And then I'll fast forward the story significantly. An agent contacted me one day after a certain reporter, who may or may not be on this panel, wrote an article about me for Newsweek. And literally, like, the next morning, less than 24 hours later, Lisa Akis, who's my agent, called me and said, do you want to write a cookbook? And I was like, yes. I think you always say yes when someone asks you if you want to write a book. But I didn't have a book in mind. I'd not, honestly, my mother always knew I was going to write a book, but I had never imagined writing a book. And I did see it as an opportunity. So for those of y'all who haven't written books, the process of writing a book is so many levels and layers. Is this the direction we want to go in? Okay. So many different levels and layers, but the most important, I think, aspect of the process, right? You write a book proposal. Book proposals are quite long. Mine was about 60 pages. And in a lot of ways, if any of y'all have done an annotated bibliography in school, you do that for a cookbook, so it's a good skill. You write a proposal. There are some sample chapters and some sample recipes and all these other things. But the most important thing for me was figuring out what my book was going to be about and what my contribution to the field was, to what I was saying about filling in gaps and finding a fresh angle. Like, those journalistic principles informed everything about my book. I was like, okay, who are we not hearing from? Puerto Ricans. Check. All right. That's our boxes checked. What style is sort of becoming popular but isn't quite fully manifested? Narrative cookbooks. And I landed on that really quickly because I found that there were these three Asian male chefs who had written actually very decent narrative cookbooks. And there were David Chang. The Momofuku cookbook is really good. Roy Choi's book is dope and super fun. And then Eddie Huang's book. Which ended up being turned into a TV show. And I just loved the style. There's also this book called Taste Like Cuba that didn't do particularly well, but it's a very narrative. It's like a novel with recipes. And I am a self-taught home cook. I don't have a restaurant. I've never been culinarily trained. I have no business writing a cookbook that has 500 recipes in it, right? I don't have that many recipes in my body. But 60 recipes felt reasonable to me, and then lots and lots of stories. So you'll see as I pass it around that the book is literally 50-50 recipes to stories. And I chose that style, again, because it felt like something that people seemed to really be enjoying, but I wasn't seeing a whole lot of it in the market. And I wasn't really seeing a whole lot of it written by a Latina woman who happens to be from the South. So along the way, in the process of like thinking about what the story was, I landed on memoir. And my decision to land on memoir partly comes from having had a feminist education as an undergrad. I was a women's studies major and became, hey, Maria. I remember as a young woman reading thoughts and ideas from like feminist activists and heroes of mine about how important personal narrative was and how critical it was for people to write from within their communities to fill in the gaps and replace the erasures on our communities with actual stories that were real and that were true. And I'm sharing all that because like along the way I had all of these considerations. I had the market in mind, I had audiences in mind. Because ultimately, my audience is the nation, right? Like, as a person who's publishing one of the few Puerto Rican cookbooks that's been produced in the last 10 years, there's literally been only one other one by Jose Santaella, who's a Puerto Rican-based restaurateur, you know? So his book is, poo, you know, it's like beautiful and shiny. So I had the nation. My ideals, my very unique background of having happened by, you know, like the universe, who've been born in Puerto Rico and raised in the American South and gone back and forth a lot and had this tremendous opportunity to compare and contrast the food ways of those two places and to naturally start to see the intersections of our cuisines and ask questions. So we were talking earlier about like looking in your pantry and asking why that thing is in there. I kept seeing for example, the way that Puerto Ricans prepare a pork shoulder or a pernil is almost identical to the way that Southerners prepare a Southern pork shoulder. And I was like, huh, look at that. And then I started finding all of these other things, like the way we prepare fried chicken is very similar. I think the icing on the cake was that I discovered that Puerto Ricans eat something called funche, which is an incredibly African-sounding word because it is an African, originally African dish, and it is corn mush. What's another word for corn mush? Grits. And the preparation was almost exactly the same, and I started to really see the parallels between Puerto Rican cooking and Southern cooking as a result of our shared African heritage. And therein, like, you know, all these things, all these, like, post-its up on my walls, photographs, spreadsheets, Google Docs, you know, the equivalent of Pinterest boards. I circled back, I mean, to our earlier conversation on being like, this is my contribution, right? Like, I am the only person that is uniquely positioned to write this exact kind of book from this perspective. I am a super nerd. I am deeply intellectually engaged with my subject matter. I know a ton about the Caribbean. And I couldn't write a book that didn't have also like an intellectual critical lens. So how much more time do I have? One more minute? I feel like it's important to talk about, okay, so that's my book, right? How do you sell a book like that, even when you have an agent? So my process for selling that book was actually really painful and challenging because the first round of book proposal unilaterally declined, unilaterally rejected. Largely, at least what the publishers were willing to say to me was that I didn't have enough of a social media platform for them to even consider the concept. And so I spent the next year building an audience, doing a number of different things. I gave a TEDx talk, also thanks to Kathy. I hired a freelance social media consultant to just do that stuff for me for a little while I could build everything else up. I started to freelance and write and try to like build a community and an audience. And then I redid the proposal and sent it back out again and then landed on University Press of Florida. And which was challenging in a lot of ways because university presses do not have a budget, right? Like they really, your budget is low for your advance, your budget is low for marketing. But the benefit was that my editor at University Press was, she really got my project. Like the first conversation we had, she was like, I think this is brilliant. I think it's so interesting. I think you're the one to tell it and you should do it. And I want to be the one to help you do it. And I was like, okay, then we'll do it. Okay, that's it.
We will get to hear more. Do you want me to go next to her? Is she back? Because I could. We can wait another minute.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Can you put my thing up? Okay. I'm going to be the moderator, and I'm also going to talk a little bit. So I was going to play a radio piece for you, but I decided not to. So I haven't yet come out and said that John is my husband, so I'm just outed us. So John and I were living in San Francisco last winter, and we've been together really, really, really long time, and he always wanted to drive cross country, and I said no for 40 years, and finally last year I said yes. But I needed a task, and of course it was food. And so I said, you drive, I'll figure out where we're going to eat every night, but we're not going to eat at the places. We're going to eat... I wanted to answer this question, is regional American food still alive? And if so, is it healthy? And I pitched the piece to the food editor at the Washington Post, Joe Yonan, and I've written for him a bunch, and he's like, I think it sounds fun, but you need to always be focused on the question. So having a title before we even hit the road helped me keep my focus. It wasn't just like, oh, well, we had this great meal. It was like, is this adding to the question? Am I getting closer to an answer? I'm just going to read you the first paragraph because it goes back to our conversation about voice. We had so many encounters. It was an 18-day trip. We had our 14-year-old yellow lab in the back who was miserable. So we, you know, when we'd eat, we were always thinking, is the dog okay? We got to go. And there were so many different encounters in different places I could have started, but I knew I needed a scene. And I knew I needed a voice, and I knew I needed people to understand that I was only sort of halfway in on this trip. There was still part of me that's like, why can't we get on a plane and be home tomorrow? You know, my adventurous spirit hadn't. So I found it on one of our almost last stops in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Where are y'all from? It was a question we heard frequently on our cross-country journey. This time the person asking was Crystal, our waitress at Bee's, a family-run fried chicken restaurant on the outskirts of Chattanooga, Tennessee. I paused. Well, it's a good question. We've been spending time on the West Coast this winter with family, and now we're driving across country to our home in Maine. We stop in a different city every few days. Crystal's eyes lit up, and she touched the top of my arm and squeezed it ever so gently. I just knew you'd been everywhere. Tell me everything. For close to 25 years, my husband has been begging me to drive cross-country with him. We live in a rural town in southern Maine, and to accomplish even the simplest task, get a quart of milk, visit a friend, pick up a paper, we have to drive. So for me, driving is a chore. But after all these years, I succumbed. And then you go through this story of trying to find real regional food, and some of it's funny, I hope. And some of it is also a straight-out travel piece. Here's a list of sort of quirky places we found. A lot of it's embarrassing because I spend an enormous amount of time on my phone while we're passing utterly spectacular scenery. But having that title and having that question, so when we got halfway, I think it was in North Carolina, I called Joe and I said, I definitely have a story. And I'm definitely impressed. There is like regional food happening in a way bigger way than I thought. And we talked it through, and he was like, okay, so I sort of got the assignment halfway through the trip. And, you know, that just made me like even more vigilant. It's like, we did go to a few white tablecloth restaurants, but only because they were telling a story about a city and about a region and about a place that I thought would inform the piece and inform. So I was lucky, I sold it halfway through. I was lucky because I had a question. I was lucky because I had a driver. And I didn't even want to come home. When we were done, I ended up like loving this. I was like, let's keep going. It gets addictive. And I loved writing about it and chronicling this. And as much as he let me use my voice, I also had to narrate a story of a journey. So structurally, it was easy. I knew where I was beginning, and I knew the end was home. And in between, there were a whole lot of meals. You know, I didn't get into the marital fights and the dog almost throwing up and all of that. But I knew what my focus was, and it helped me a whole lot. And another thing that I think we touched on this morning, I had so much fun. It was so much fun to write. And you should feel some of that, whatever you're doing. It should be like, I'm actually working on a memoir right now that has very little to do with food, and so many teachers and people I've spoken to have said, if you're not learning as you go, if you don't know where you're going and you feel you're in the dark, you're on the right path. So we're telling you, got to know where you're going, you got to know your title, you got to know your audience, but I'm also telling you that some darkness can be really beneficial also. And for me, we knew where we were going most nights, but not always. Chattanooga, Tennessee, Crystal, this gift, this fried chicken place, we ended up being in a heavy storm, and they said there were tornado warnings, and we weren't going to make it to Memphis. And I'm like, shit, we're going to Chattanooga, Tennessee, I guess. That's the next place. And I'm like, we're never going to find a place to eat there. And it kept popping up with fried chicken places, and there was one in town, and few people raved and a few people hated it, and then this place with Crystal showed up, and we walked in, and it was stuck in time in 1950 with linoleum tile and Lazy Susans, and everything was homemade and like every Southern specialty that you dream of, and it was, what, $13 for all you can eat, and there was Crystal, and there was this place, and it was like, bingo! So it informed the story. But then the next night, I didn't know where I was going. So there was that feeling of discovery, which should never be missing in whatever you're working on. So here.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite episodes. So, okay, I did...
This is so good.
I did a handout, 10 things I learned, like, or I wish I'd known, and I'm happy to send that out. But I thought I'd talk about this in the Must They Motherfucker episode, because like I go to this conference in Vermont called Breadloaf, and I meet this brilliant young poet, Mitali Desai. And Mitali Desai reads this poem in the open mic one night about the way in which a guy is trying to hit on her by making curry references. When you get a chance, just listen. So here's this young Barnard student, and she reads a poem called Namaste, Motherfucker. And it's about the way in which this guy is trying to hit on her by making really offensive comments about curry. And the last line of the poem is, Namaste, Motherfucker. So I heard it, and she and I were in the same workshop together, so I approached her and I said, could you record this for us, just on your iPhone, go to a closet or somewhere quiet, like a closed room. And so she did, and then when I got that file, I was like, oh, I think if we take this file, and then I'll talk a little bit in the intro about my experiences as an Indian American and my fraught relations with the word curry, and then we add Nabin's interview about his book, then I think we can make something interesting. One thing that I keep going back to is a quote by a poet who says, sometimes a poem needs to go deeper by going elsewhere. And I feel like sometimes when we pitch shows or when we do episodes, like I think this episode with curry, by going elsewhere, by finding this young Indian American poet, I think that the show did something very different. And that's one of the things that I've learned with podcasting is I would love to do a complex show. Like every month I probably get a few. Oh, here we go. Finally. Okay. Well, here we go. I won't take up too much time, but these are 10 lessons. I want to just highlight a few of them. One of them is number 6, I'm not Ira Glass. I can't tell you how many times I get emails from people who say, I want to make a This American Life, but the Filipino version. I get so many emails like that. And I would love a This Filipino American Life show, but that requires a degree of funding and expertise that most of us don't have. So I think part of what I've had to learn as a podcaster is about my own limitations, number one. Number two is we've never done anything for free. We've paid everyone, not a lot, but I've always been paid by doing this podcast from the very, very, very first month. Not a lot. Some months I've only made $25. Some months I've made a few hundred dollars. But it's never been nothing. And so if you're going to start a passion project, I would say monetize it as soon as possible. Because while I'm a big believer of passion, I'm a bigger believer in paying your bills. Right. So that's partly like when my partner sees me late at night doing racist sandwich stuff, I can say, well, it is paying something. Not as much as I would like. So monetize it as soon as possible. I think most of these are self-explanatory, but I just want to echo what Kathy said, which is follow your curiosity and not your sentimentality. I always find that when Soleil and I talk about whether or not we want to continue our podcast, the one question we keep asking ourselves is, are we learning something new? Like, I just met someone from Nevada, if I can call Christy, and I was like, wow, that's so cool. Like, there's a possibility that we can now do a Nevada episode. I don't know much about what it's like to be a chef of color in Nevada. So I'm like, that's so cool if that happens, not to put you on the spot. But so that's the one thing I would say, follow your curiosity and monetize it as soon as possible. Otherwise, most of my friends who have podcasts have given up because of the frustration of working for free.
So we have like 10 minutes left and I want to have you guys ask some questions. How about if each of you very succinctly, tell me what the biggest obstacle and or the biggest surprise has been in putting together this work.
So, okay, so can we pull up my story?
Oh, yeah, sure. What is the
Tolstar
magazine? Of course.
You'll see, what's the second story down? No, the next one. So, coming from a traditional media background, there's always this desire to be super competitive and trying to keep up with like what everyone else is doing. What I've noticed with Tostada is that people are reading my content because they can't find it anywhere else. So like, I did a story a month or two ago on Tunde Wei, famous chef, provocateur, writer, chef, everything. Hardly anybody read it. Why? Because they could read about it in the free press, they could read about it in the New York Times or, you know, all these other major publications. It's been done to death. So why would they go to, you know, little Tostada magazine to read that? I published this story last week. Nobody was writing about it. I mean, this is a woman who, you know, who at the height of the recession in Detroit, which was like the epicenter of all economic turmoil, she and her husband started this taco truck. It had no name, it had no identity. It could have been any random place, but they created a brand around it. They created a special recipe around it. They created this community. And you know, kind of going back to what you were saying about starting with a headline, my headline was pretty much that. Like, I pretty much just wanted to say that Nancy Lopez is the queen of the taco trucks in Detroit. So, you know, I played around with the wording a little bit, but I kept it simple and I kept it along that theme. And I worked my way through it. So, again, just going back to this, like, we're talking about overcoming obstacles. The obstacle for me was to tell a story that couldn't be found anywhere else. And honestly, I shared it with Martina, and I shared it with Nancy's cousin, just on text, privately. By the time I woke up the next morning, it had gone viral within the Latino community in Detroit. Why? Because there's no other outlet in Detroit that speaks to Latinos. And it is as simple as that. And so I think when we're talking about, like, if I have a piece of advice for you, don't chase those trendy stories. Go after what you know that nobody else knows about, because those are the stories that are going to make you stand out.
Uh-huh.
It got shared hundreds of times.
That was just mine.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to just mention with Serena, like something that she had mentioned to me is like the woman factor. You want to just talk about that a little bit?
Right. Here's the thing that I've found interesting in launching Tolstada magazine. Like, the first idea in general was, I want this to star people of color. Well, even within the people of color criteria, unfortunately, a lot of times The stories will be centered around men, male chefs, male restaurant owners. Men have the clout. Men have more resources, and that is, and so that's one of the things that I noticed, like shifting the focus away from the man and on this woman. You know, she talked about how, you know, her husband might come up with these ideas, but it's really up to her to make it happen. And so I think that resonated with a lot of the readers.
So you found your sort of purpose, it sounds like, through this trial and error. Zahir, do you have a surprise obstacle? Quick story, we have very little time.
Okay. Yeah, so we really wanted Roxane Gay when her book Hunger came out, and she couldn't come on her show. So we ended up getting Virgie Tovar, and it turned out to be like a huge blessing, because we were able to explore issues about being Latinx and being living in a fat body, and it was amazing. And she just went to places in the interview that we didn't think. So sometimes when someone says no, second thing is oftentimes the high-profile guests are more risk-averse. Whereas with Virgie, she just went there and really called out some awful trends in the food industry. Not that Roxane Gay doesn't go to uncomfortable places. So sometimes a no can really lead to some new possibilities.
Super quick, money. Writing a cookbook is an incredibly laborious process. It involves a lot of purchasing of ingredients. It involves travel. It involves photography. It involves recipe testing. It involves creating space for yourself to write, which means taking time off work. I had to do a writing residency in order to focus. I traveled back and forth to Puerto Rico. I funded most of my own photography. I also funded 100% of my publicist to help me get the word out about my book. And I think that that challenge is something faced by a lot of people that have book ideas that are not sort of immediately recognizable as something that sells, because ultimately the biggest difference between sort of online digital media or writing articles in journalism is that books have to sell. It is an object that is intended to be sold, and book sales and getting book sales become an incredibly critical part of every component of it. And you know, when you have a very small advance and you come from a background like mine where there is literally no one in my family that had any money to loan me to do this project, I worked a full-time gig plus freelanced full-time and wrote this book at the same time, and that is still my life. So, money.
And on that optimistic note, how about some questions? It doesn't get that much prettier. It's a tough financial picture. There are people making lots of money selling cookbooks, but mostly there are people, that's why you really have to love this.
Yeah.
Questions for any of us?
So I guess just a quick follow-up to that, and then also to what you had said, Zahir, and I think you mentioned it a little bit as well, Serena. This is across mediums I'm seeing, too, the idea of having some way to either monetize something or have some sort of a financial stream. So what are some of the things you've relied on, looked into? I know you had mentioned kind of freelancing and then working full-time, but what are other sort of things that you've sort of leaned on to get that off the ground?
Well, I would just say, after doing this for a long time, that I am almost always working on radio shows, a book, magazine article, and a newspaper article, often simultaneously, but mixing it up. Some of them pay really well, some of them pay pathetically, and in my mind, I try to balance it out. But the more skills that you can obtain, and the more platforms that you can talk, the larger your voice can be, and the larger your pocketbook could potentially be. Other thoughts?
Yeah, so very few podcasters make money on podcasting. Like, we get money from Patreon, and then we did a Kickstarter, we raised about $13,000, but most of that was covering cost of producers and stuff. Where we've been able to monetize it is Soleil and I, she's a co-host, we've been given speaking opportunities. Mm-hmm. I've done a few corporate events, not many. I get invited to write for different publications. Soleil does workshops. I've done a workshop. So that's a way to monetize it. But the podcast itself, I think, but when you do monetize or when you do ask, do a Kickstarter, you need to convey why podcasting, or like Advan said about writing a cookbook, why it is expensive. That going to, you know, when I went to Detroit last October to do our episode, I had to get a hotel for 3 days, had to get, you know, gas money, food, etc. Oftentimes people don't realize how much cost is involved in doing a narrative episode, how many hours, what it costs to produce a piece of audio. So that's really important, to constantly on your show. And then to seek out advertisers who are like-minded. Our name is both an advantage and a disadvantage. Some advertisers don't like our name, others really like it a lot. It's just a question of whether or not, and we chose a name that's intentionally polarizing. So we have to find those advertisers who are aligned with our ideals and want to support us.
Serena, are you making money?
I have some money.
I mean, that's, you don't have to answer that.
Yeah, it's a little bit of just constantly working. I'm freelancing full time. I've found that it's useful to have like a consistent gig if you can find it, if you're lucky enough. So if you have a monthly income stream from one particular source, and then you can fill it out with the other sources. I was also lucky enough to receive grant money to fund Tostada magazine, and that allows me to pay myself a stipend every month. It's not a lot. I can't just do it on my own, but along with the other freelance opportunities, I'm able to, you know, kind of like have this robust source of income. I'll also say though, because people are asking me a lot, like, oh, how do I win a grant? You know, like, where are these grants and stuff? And you know, living in Detroit and knowing like the economic conditions of this city, there's a lot of foundation money here. So, you know, disclaimer, like that definitely helped. But what also helped me was developing a really solid business plan. Create a template, work on it little by little, hammer out that mission statement. Those things are going to help you when you do find those kind of like fellowships or grant opportunities. So you have it in place. So you can say, oh yeah, the deadline's next week. Oh, I already have my packet ready. And so I think that's what made Tostada really stand out in that way.
Yeah, hopefully. I think we have time for one more quick question. I would also just say generically that many writers I know, and I would include myself, I always have a passion project.
Yeah.
And then I usually try to have a money project.
Yeah.
And they often have nothing to do with each other. Other quick question? Great. Okay.